everybody. Welcome to the NFL History Podcast, the podcast all about NFL history. I am your host, Caleb. Today I'm joined by Tony and Marcus. How are you guys doing today?
Good.
Doing pretty good. How about you? Good.
I'm doing really good. I'm really excited to start recording this podcast. We've been talking about it for a few weeks now, and it's going to be a fun episode, I think, and it's going to be a fun podcast in general.
Yeah, there's a lot to talk about.
So I'm excited.
A lot of history before today, so we got a lot to talk about.
Yeah, absolutely. So just a little bit of background on the podcast, I guess. The three of us got together and we decided we wanted to do an NFL history podcast, and after a little bit of discussion, we decided that talking about the merger would be a good place to start overall, but we didn't want to just hop in at 1970. We wanted to do a little bit of background, and so we're splitting up the merger as an event into about four or five different episodes. So today is the first episode of that series, and it's going to be the history of the NFL from 1920 to 1960, and a little bit before, to just talk about football as it was before the NFL, because the NFL obviously was not the start of football either.
Yeah.
So you guys ready to hop in then?
I am. I'm excited.
I'm ready.
All right, great. So let's go ahead and talk about football. Like I said, before the NFL, we can talk about where football started. And that was all the way back in medieval times. So we're talking
medieval.
12, 1300s here.
BC obviously, or AD?
AD.
Okay.
Good right. Clarification.
Yeah, the medieval times happened in the 80s, but...
yeah.
So it's obviously not the same sport that we know today. It was a lot different back then, but it's similar enough so that you can kind of trace it back to this. But what these people would do is two villages would kind of meet up in one village, and it would be one village versus the other. Everybody from one village versus everybody from the other village. And they would have some sort of ball. They didn't really have the same type of balls we have now, so maybe it was like an inflated bladder or something crazy
that. Yeah.
And then basically the goal of the game was to get the ball to the other side of the village. And whoever got to the far side of the village first won. And that was the only rule.
Well, it's not really football, but...
Well,
fair enough.
That's what I'm saying.
It's like some sort of like soccer almost, but you have to just like free... I don't know.
So like the only rule was to get the ball to the other side of the village and you could do whatever you wanted to stop someone or get there.
Yeah.
Crazy.
I don't think I'd want to play that.
Yeah, it seems pretty dangerous. Obviously, I haven't seen a game like this, but I assume people were just like throwing the ball around, tackling each other like crazy, pushing each other.
There were sticks.
Yeah, I don't know if there were sticks involved, but if there were, I would not play.
There wasn't any rules. I'd use a stick if there wasn't any rules.
Well, I don't know if there was absolutely no rules, but because a stick seems a little far. So anyway, we fast forward a couple hundred years, and we get to college football. And the first college football game was between the College of New Jersey and Rutgers College, and it was on November 6th, 1869.
Where was it at?
In New Jersey.
In New Jersey. Sounds cold.
Do you know the results of that game at all?
The score was 8-0 in favor of the College of New Jersey. So that was the first organized football game. Obviously, it wasn't professional. It was just college, a couple colleges meeting up and playing together. And then the first professionals to play football came around in 1892 when a couple players were paid like $6 or something to play in a game. So it was technically professional because they were being paid to play.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm guessing even back then football was still way different than what it is today, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I think in this college game they hadn't legalized passing yet.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
the first college game. So it was definitely different, yeah. Even when the NFL started in 1920, which is kind of what we're building up to here, football was a lot different then even, where they didn't pass the ball nearly as much as they do, as they did even 10 years later.
Yeah.
So then after the first professionals in 1892, there started becoming kind of these small leagues or circuits, they would call them, where it was kind of just people would form up on these teams and then you have a bunch of other teams and they just go around and play each other. And it wasn't very structured. There wasn't really, you know, any championships or anything like that. It was just a bunch of teams playing each other. And so that's kind of how football started in the medieval times and kind of moved toward the founding of the NFL. And the NFL was not the first professional league, but it's the only one that stayed around, obviously.
Yeah.
So now the year is 1920, and the NFL is founded in Ohio at a car dealership.
Yeah, in Canton.
In Canton, exactly. And Jim Thorpe was the first president. He was president for a year. In the first year, the name of the league was the American Football Professional Association, or AFPA. And they ended up changing the name to the National Football League in 1922, so 2 years after they were formed. And I'm glad they did, because AFPA does not have nearly the same ring as NFL.
Nope.
Yeah, it sounds like a players association or something now.
Yeah, exactly.
Good point.
So the first 10 seasons or so were really, really unstable. And there were a lot of teams going in and out. But some of the early teams that joined were people like the Chicago Cardinals, who are now the Arizona Cardinals. So they've been around since the first year. The Decatur Staleys.
For a long time.
Yep. The Decatur Staleys, who are now the Chicago Bears, also joined that first year. The Green Bay Packers were founded in 1919. Wow. And then joined the NFL in 1921. The New York Giants were founded in 1925. And then the Staleys, like I said, moved to Chicago and became the Bears in 1921.
Wow.
But like I said, it was really unstable. And even though there were some of those early franchises that managed to stay around all these years, in the first 10 years of the league being around, 35 franchises folded.
Huh. Wow, that's crazy.
So three and a half per year.
How many franchises were there when the NFL first started?
In the first year, there were 14 teams. So not a bad number. But like I said, a lot of those teams, well, 12 of them disappeared eventually. Wow. Because it was really unstable. And one of those teams that folded, Tony did a little bit of research on, so I'm going to flip it over to him, but was the Canton Bulldogs. So, Tony, why don't you tell us a little bit about them?
Yeah, so it was established November 15th, 1904, as the Canton Athletic Club, and it was like a club designed to have baseball and football teams. And then, of course, they joined the NFL right at the beginning. So Jim Thorpe was a part of the Canton Bulldogs, like we mentioned Jim Thorpe earlier. So he was signed in 1915. And he was paid $250 a game. And so this was the league's and, I mean, most of football's, like, biggest player at the time. And he was a guy that got a lot of people watching.
$250 a game, that seems like a lot, actually.
It seems like a lot back then, yeah. So he was So it was 1915. Yeah, so he was actually, before this, he participated in the 1912 Olympics. And he competed in the pentathlon and the decathlon, pentathlon has 5 events, decathlon has 10. And he earned gold medals in both, so he won both of them. And then what's kind of crazy was before he participated in the decathlon, he had his shoes stolen. So he had his shoes stolen, and then he just, like, looked and found 2 other mismatching shoes, one he pulled from the garbage, and then won. So...
Oh my gosh, are you serious?
Yeah, then he won the decathlon, and out of the 15 events between the pentathlon and decathlon, he won 8 of them. So he was pretty impressive, and so when he signed to play football, people became a little more interested. So his first game, he didn't play that much, but then in the second game, he became the team's head coach, which a lot of the teams back then had player head coaches.
What the heck?
And so seems
like a lot of responsibility.
Yeah, all at once. The head coach, the captain, and then the team won 6-0, and he kicked both the field goals. So
oh my gosh!
He was all over.
This guy did everything.
Wow.
Yeah, and so then, like you said, it was founded in a car dealership in Canton, the NFL was, and he was the founder, and then, like you said again, he was the first president of that, which he was the first president, and it was founded in 1920. Then he retired after the 1920 season.
Yep.
But so these first 2 years, they played in 1920, 1921. The Bulldogs were 9-5-4, so 9 wins, 5 losses, 4 ties. And they expected to be better than they were, but then the competition was a little more stiffer than they'd expected. But then, so before the 1922 season, their team manager, which is like basically their general manager, right, Ralph Hay, hired Guy Chamberlain as their new like player coach. Okay. And then together they switched up the team a lot. They only kept 5 former players. And then it worked out, though, because 1921, 1922, or 1922, 1923, they won back-to-back championships and didn't lose a game.
So, just to be clear, is Jim Thorpe on this team?
No, so he retired 1920.
Okay.
Like, right, so he played the 1920 season with the Bulldogs, okay, and then retired. So okay, he was only actually in the NFL, which then, like you said, is American Pro Football Association, for just 1 year.
Okay, so he was the president of the league,
mm-hmm,
the owner of the team, and he played on the team?
So he was he didn't own the team. He was the, okay, he was the head coach, though, and played on it. The guy who owned it and was also like the general manager was a guy named Ralph Hay.
Okay.
So, yeah, so then they win back-to-back championships, and in this 1922, they actually beat the Chicago Cardinals, which we talked about, who are now the Arizona Cardinals.
Mm-hmm.
And they won 20-3, and Guy Chamberlain, who's now the player coach, he had 2 interceptions to return for touchdowns and then blocked a punt, which led to a touchdown.
Holy cow.
So it was a lot back then. It was, if you have one guy, you have a good chance.
Right, and especially where a lot of the early players would play on both sides of the ball, so they can make double the impact.
Yep. Yeah, so then that following year, after they had won back-to-back championships and been undefeated, Ralph Hay sold the team to Sam Dutch. He was the current owner of the Cleveland Indians, which isn't to be confused with the baseball team, the Indians. They're not related. Right. This guy, the owner, Sam Dutch, he buys the team, brings them to Cleveland, and takes 7 of the players, including Guy Chamberlain. Guy Chamberlain stayed the captain, and then renamed them the Cleveland Bulldogs. That next season, they won the championship in Cleveland, and then he sold the franchise back a year later in 1925 to Canton. So they got their team back, which the talent that was pretty excited about. But then in 1925, they had a record of 4-4, so kind of underwhelming. And then the next year, 1926, they were 1-9-3, so 1 win, 9 losses, 3 ties. And then in 1927, the NFL decided they were kind of purge the league of the bad teams, and that included the Canton Bulldogs. So they ended up getting kicked out of the league.
So they were one of the 35 teams to fold in those first 10 years.
Yeah, and so, I mean, they almost folded twice. They were moved from Canton over to Cleveland and then moved back.
Right, right.
Then Canton is now the home of the Pro Football Hall of Fame.
Yep, that's right.
And this team was a big part of that. So there were 3 main things that led to it. So number 1 was the NFL was created in Canton.
Yep.
And then number 2 was how good the Canton Bulldogs were. Early on, they were the first team to win 2 championships in the league.
Okay.
And then the 3rd was Jim Thorpe. He was, I mean, the first big-name athlete to play football. Brought a lot of people to football and made it a bigger thing.
Yep.
So those were the 3 main things. And then, so in late 1959, a newspaper in Canton wrote something pointing out these reasons why the Hall of Fame should be located there. And this caught on with all the citizens. Like, everyone was like, and Canton was like, yes, that's definitely, it should be here. And so then they kind of like petitioned the NFL and were trying to get them to designate the Canton as the where the Hall of Fame would be.
Right.
And so the NFL did. And then Canton raised almost $400,000 to build the Hall of Fame.
Wow.
And then It was built and opened in September 7th, 1963. So.
Wow, that's awesome.
Okay, I have a question. Yeah. Kind of backtracking a little bit, but you said that after 1 year, Jim Thorpe retired. Was there ever like a reason why? Because it seems like he had a lot going for him. Obviously, kind of founding the NFL, and it seems like he was the best player on the team, and it kind of seems weird to retire after 1 year.
Well, so it was just after 1 year in the NFL. So he played with the Bulldogs from 1950 to 1920.
Oh, okay.
And then just retired at 1920. So, I mean, at the time he retired, he was 33. So he was a little older, especially then. But he still ended up playing professional sports, just doing different things on and off almost. And he ended up, like, getting out of it and then had to work a bunch of different jobs when he was done with football because it kind of coincided with the Great Depression when he was done. Mm-hmm. And then, which is crazy now, because now if you played football, you're set for life practically if you were the president of the NFL.
Yeah.
But yeah, he ended up having to work a bunch of different jobs.
Yeah.
And stuff like that. And then ended up dying in 1953 from heart failure. So, he's had to work a ton of just different odd random jobs here and there, pretty much, you know, like almost anyone during the Great Depression after being this one of the most famous athletes in America. So after
that first year, he didn't really have any involvement with the NFL after that, right?
No, not really.
Yeah, not too much.
Wow.
And then just, you know, we mentioned that he made $250 per game. In 2019, that translates to roughly $6,300, a little bit more maybe.
Okay. So I mean,
it's a decent amount compared.
Yeah, compared to today, it's almost nothing though.
Yeah, I mean, considering though that the league was that there wasn't even a real league in 1915, it's a decent amount of money if I'm being honest.
Yeah,
and so he also played professional baseball from 1913 to 1919.
Wow.
So he was actually playing baseball too while he was playing football. So
very cool.
I mean, he was an all-around athlete. Pretty crazy.
Very cool. All right, that's awesome, Tony. That's a really cool story.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy, the whole thing.
Yeah.
Football back then is just not nearly what it is now.
Yeah, it was very different. Another story that kind of happened at the same time, there was there's a team called the Detroit Wolverines, and they had a player named Benny Friedman, and he was a quarterback, and he was electric. And on another part of the country, there were the New York Giants, and they were not a good team in 1928.
Sounds like nothing's changed.
Right. They couldn't give their tickets away. Nobody wanted to come to the games. So Tim Mara, who was the owner of the Giants, was watching the game when they were playing the Detroit Wolverines. And he saw this guy, Benny Friedman, and he was tearing the Giants up. It was crazy. And so Tim Mara calls up the Detroit Wolverines and he says, "Hey, will you trade me Benny Friedman? Because I need a better player on my team to help draw in the crowds." And the Detroit Wolverines said, "No, we are not going to trade you our best player." So
right,
what?
That makes sense.
Yeah. So what did Tim Mara do? He bought the entire franchise.
Wow.
Destroyed the franchise, but kept Benny Friedman on the Giants because the Giants owned the rights to him after they bought the Detroit Wolverines.
Mm-hmm. Power move. Wow.
But the other thing about Benny Friedman is he holds a very unique NFL record in that he, in a single season, led the NFL in passing touchdowns and rushing touchdowns.
Wow.
Which will never, ever happen again.
Passing touchdowns and rushing touchdowns?
Yep, in a single season.
Wow.
Yeah, that probably won't ever happen again. Yeah.
I think he passed for 10 touchdowns that season. So wow. You can see where we've come in that time, that was the league leader.
Yeah, that's incredible. Now what, 55? Was right. Just last year, right?
No, last year was 50. Or
50 for Patrick Mahomes and 55 for Manning.
For Peyton Manning, yeah.
Yeah, wow. From 10. That's crazy. Yeah,
crazy.
So we have definitely changed. And how many rushing touchdowns did Peyton get that year? Probably zero.
Probably zero. Mahomes probably had a couple last year.
He probably had like 5 or 6.
Yeah, but he's not going to lead the league in rushing touchdowns.
No, most likely not. It'd probably take a lot of QB sneaks or something, but yeah, it'll probably never happen.
Yeah. So, and he's the only person ever to do it in all of NFL history, and it'll never happen again. So I think that's really, really cool.
Yeah, that is cool.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Obviously, buying a whole franchise for one player is quite an investment. Do you know if the Giants got any return on that, if they won any championships because of him or anything?
So in 1929, they had a 13-1-1 record, which was second best in the NFL that year.
So that would not have won the championship.
Yeah, because it was just like a table almost, whatever.
So I guess you could say the investment really didn't pay off. I mean, obviously, they did get more
fans.
They
were better.
And they were better.
Yeah, I think that was probably the main point, was to bring in more people. I think that was part of what made Jim Thorpe so great, too, for the Bulldogs, is there's... Back then, there wasn't obviously now everyone loves football practically, but then there wasn't nearly as many people going to the games or anything. So I think that was probably more of the investment for them, was not necessarily winning, but getting more people to their games.
Yeah.
Yep, exactly.
Yeah.
So those first years from like 1920 to about 1933, there was almost no structure in the league. There wasn't really a fixed schedule. There was no championship game. They would just award the championship to the best team, whichever team had the best record. And that actually led to some controversy, because there were like disputed championships and like emergency tiebreakers to try and get the championship to the right people.
Right.
But then in 1933, it was kind of the turning point in NFL history, because in that year, the NFL had what you might call the Big Seven when it came to owners. And these seven people were probably the most influential people when it came to establishing the NFL as we know it today. So the seven people were George Halas, who owned the Bears.
Yep.
Charlie Bidwell, who owned the Cardinals. George Marshall, who at the time owned the Boston Redskins, later moved to Washington, so the Washington Redskins. Burt Bell, who owned the Philadelphia Eagles. Art Rooney, who owned the Pittsburgh, originally Pirates, later Steelers. Tim Mara, who owned the Giants. And Curly Lambeau, who owned the Packers.
An interesting note there. I don't know about all the teams, but I know the Giants are still owned by the Maras. So it's been one ownership the
same
whole time.
Same with the Bears.
Bears,
still the Halas.
The Steelers.
And the Steelers, yep.
The Bidwells still own the Cardinals.
Yep.
So not only are these franchises been around these whole years, but they also, a lot of them have stayed with the same people as well.
Yeah, the same families.
Yep. And so like I said, these seven were the people who really made the league from this ramshackle bunch of people, teams just kind of playing each other, into a real league. So in 1933, they were down to 10 teams. They split into two divisions. The division winners would play the championship game. So 1933 was the first year with a championship game. And that idea was proposed by the Redskins owner, George Marshall.
Well,
so we see, that big change, one of those big changes coming right here. In 1936, the first draft was held, and that idea was proposed by Burt Bell, who owned the Philadelphia Eagles. And part of the reason to propose this rule or the draft is because the Eagles are so bad. So he went to the owners and he says, "This league is as strong as the weakest link. The Eagles are the weakest link, and we are going to tear this league apart if we don't have a draft."
So
where we pick in reverse order, so that then we get the best teams or the best players.
Yeah, if I'm not wrong, before then it was just like a bidding war basically for the college players. And so, I mean, at that point, the best teams are going to be able to pay the most money.
Yep.
And the rich is just going to get richer, so.
Exactly. And so Burt Bell tried to sign this big college player. I can't remember his name off the top of my head. But he was outbid by the Brooklyn Dodgers. the football team, not the baseball team.
Right.
And he was really upset, and that kind of led to the idea of a draft where the worst teams pick first, and so then and then they have the signing rights to the college player that they draft.
Yeah, and then what's crazy is I've actually read about this too. The first pick was the first Heisman Trophy winner, Jay Berwinger. He was a running back, and so the Eagles picked him and then traded him to the Bears, and then that guy didn't play ever. Wow. In the NFL. Yeah.
Yep. And then also in the 30s, we saw a lot more passing introduced. So before, you know, in the 20s, it was just these big scrums and these people just tried to get forward a little, you know, a few yards at a time. And so they decided, okay, passing needs to come into the game more. It makes it more exciting. It opens things up more. And it really did change the game a lot. So a couple other teams joined in the 1930s. We have the Cleveland Rams, who would later move to L.A.
And then to St. Louis?
Yep, then to St. Louis,
and then
back to
L.A.
Yeah. So they've been all over the place. And part of the reason they let the Cleveland Rams in is because they were in Cleveland, and these owners wanted to keep it moderately local still.
Right.
They were kind of scared to branch out at the time. And then in 1941, they introduced the commissioner. So before, they just had a league president who was more or less didn't have, I guess he didn't have very much power. So they introduced the commissioner office and give him a lot more power to change rules and kind of, you know, guide where the league is going. And the first commissioner was Elmer Layden, and he was one of the four horsemen running backs at Notre Dame, one of the famous backfielders there.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And because he was a big college football player, it helped bring some of that name recognition to the league and help boost their popularity that way.
Yeah.
The other thing about the 30s, I guess, is that nobody was making any money still. The league has been around for 10 plus years, and it's almost impossible for these people to turn a profit just because football wasn't that popular.
Yeah.
Back then. But these people, these seven owners especially, loved football so much, and they really believed that it could become the best sport in America, that they just kept pushing forward, even through the losses, even through these hard times, and they managed to push through. And obviously, we see where the NFL is now, and it is the most popular sport in America.
Yeah.
Because of the vision of these seven people and their commitment to making it succeed.
And thank goodness that they kept on pushing.
Yeah, no kidding.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, millions of people love the NFL, so I'm happy that these seven people are around to make sure that the NFL got to where it is today.
Yeah.
That kind of, you know, takes us through the 30s and kind of those big changes where they started, you know, in the 20s with no organization, and now they're starting to have more organization, some better rules to make the NFL, you know, more competitive, more fun to watch. And then America enters World War II, and the NFL takes a little bit of a step back because of the war.
Yep.
And Marcus, I think you said you did a little bit of research. Tell us a little bit about the year.
Yeah. So we're just gonna start from the very beginning. On December 7th, 1941, Pearl Harbor was bombed, which is when World War II kind of started. While that was happening over at Pearl Harbor, the Brooklyn Dodgers were playing the New York Giants. And during that game, when that happened, the announcer actually stopped the game and announced that all servicemen should report to their units immediately because of the attack on Pearl Harbor. So that was kind of just an interesting little tidbit that he...
So they were playing the game when it happened?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yep.
Yeah, that's kind
of
scary.
It happened at 12 o'clock. So it was all the way on the other side of the nation, but still for the announcer to kind of stop the game and say that there was just an attack and all servicemen should report to their units immediately would be a little shocking to me, I think.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, it would be shocking and it would be scary because we all know how big an event Pearl Harbor was.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But they all knew that there was a world war going on, so I'm sure that they understood, you know, the ramifications of what was happening,
mm-hmm.
of course. But like you said, it's scary to know that America is suddenly being thrust into this war, and suddenly the future is so uncertain for all these people.
Yeah. So with the start of World War II, the U.S. needed a lot of soldiers. So a very large majority of men in the United States, in one way or another, served. And that includes people who were in the NFL. So going into the 1943 season, there were not as many people in the NFL as there were in the past. At the start of the season, there were only 7 people on the Brooklyn Dodgers roster. And so they ended up pulling a lot of people out of retirement to come back and play for them so they could continue operations. But there were some teams who weren't able to continue operations, and one of those teams was the Cleveland Rams. And so they actually had to shut down for the 1943 NFL season because they just didn't have people to play.
Yeah, I think I saw that 32% of all players in the NFL ended up getting drafted.
Yeah.
Wow.
Actually,
that's crazy.
A number for you. There was a total of 994 people, NFL personnel, either players or coaches, who served in one way or another during World War II. So, a lot of people.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah.
I mean, it's awesome in the fact that they were serving their country.
Yeah. Yeah.
Not the war itself.
Yeah. Another thing that happened during the 1943 season, two other teams who didn't have very many people were the Eagles and the Steelers, and they decided instead of suspending operations for that season that they would just combine their teams together and be one team instead of two teams, and so their fans called them the Steagles, and so for the 1943 NFL season, the Steelers and the Eagles were one team.
I love the name Steagles.
Steagles, yes.
It's like, it sounds so menacing. It's so cool.
Yeah.
The Steagles.
Yeah, so that was kind of just the 1943 season, kind of some of the big storylines in that year. Going into 1944, the Steagles merger dissolved, so they were no longer the Eagles and the Steelers. And instead, the Steelers merged with the Chicago Cardinals. And that team was awful. They went 0-10 that season, and they were just not good at all.
Holy cow, that's crazy.
And the fans had a nickname for them, and now I can't remember it.
I think it was the Carpets.
Yeah.
Oh, perfect.
Yeah.
The Carpets. Because it was Card Hit.
Yeah.
The Cardinals from Pittsburgh. So they changed it to Carpets.
Yeah.
Perfect.
No one was really a fan.
Not as fun of a name as the Steagles.
Nope.
No, I think Carpets is better. I think we need an expansion team. The Carpets.
Change them to the Arizona Carpets.
Yeah.
Oh, that'd be really good.
Yeah, but they were just terrible, so no one really liked them. And so they got that nickname. While all this was going on, all the football players who were in the war serving still wanted to play football, and so there were 3 teams who were actually organized between the Army, the Navy, and the Marines. Those 3 groups organized kind of football teams, and they would actually play games every once in a while with up to 8,000 soldiers watching, just to kind of provide some entertainment for a little while they were at war. So football went on while in the war, and those guys were still kind of playing football.
Huh, that's really cool.
That is way cool.
I did find this tidbit, I'm just going to share it really quick, that I thought was really interesting. And it kind of shows the culture of America at the time in terms of sports.
Yeah.
Because everyone knows that baseball is America's pastime. But back during like World War II, it really was. Because even the president came out and said during the war that baseball should do everything it can to keep on continuing its operations, basically, because people needed, all these people who weren't actively serving were going to be working, helping the war effort, and they needed some way to recreate.
Mm-hmm.
And the president thought that baseball was one of the best ways because it was cheap and could go to a game and watch a game in 2.5 hours which would never happen today, by the way, for baseball. But he doesn't say anything about football. He just says it about baseball, you know, and that just shows where football was in relation to baseball at the time, whereas now I think people would rather have football continue over baseball if something like that were to happen.
Yeah, definitely. That's kind of crazy, but it does make sense, but it's really interesting how much has changed.
Yeah.
Another thing that I really liked, I was just kind of scrolling through and I saw this, but during the war, the NFL donated money to war efforts, and how they did that is they took all the revenue from 15 different games, which in today's money would total $680 million, and they donated that to war efforts. And that was the largest amount raised by any one organization throughout the entire war. So the NFL, the NFL did their part by obviously players going in fighting and then also donating money to those war efforts. So that was awesome.
Yeah, that's really cool.
Yeah.
That the NFL was so active in helping the war effort from America too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting tidbit.
Yeah. And then I'm just going to kind of close out with a cool story of one of the players who served in the war, and that is he was on the Chicago Cardinals. He was a fullback, and his name was Motts Tonnell, I think is how you pronounce it. He was taken prisoner in 1942 in a place called Baton. I'm not even sure where it's at, but he was taken prisoner. And he and 75,000 other troops were forced to march 60 miles over 7 days. And that was known as the Baton Death March.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, kind of crazy. Wow. But after that, he was then transported to Japan, where he was a prisoner of war for 3.5 years. And being a prisoner of war, you're not treated very well. He wasn't fed very much. But he did survive the war. And at the end of the war, he was 90 pounds, a full-grown man, 90 pounds.
Oh, my gosh.
But he said that the only reason he survived was because of his football conditioning and training. So he did survive.
Oh, that's crazy.
And then he ended up going back to the Chicago Cardinals and playing for them after the war. So.
And then playing again.
Yeah.
Wow. That's awesome.
That is incredible.
It's kind of a cool little story.
Actually, while we're talking about players who served in World War II, I have a story as well.
Okay.
There was a player who played for the Steelers, and his name was Jack Sanders. He served in the Marines, and he was on Iwo Jima, actually. And he lost his left arm, not his whole arm, but his lower arm, right, in an explosion. And he also broke one of his legs in three places.
Oh.
And he was another player who came back and he played football as well.
Wow, after?
Wow.
That's
awesome. With one arm.
Yeah.
Impressive.
Yeah. He actually didn't play that long. I think he played only 3 games. But still.
Yeah. What position did he play?
He played guard.
Okay.
It's a little vague because back then defensive linemen could also be called guards.
Right.
So maybe he played both sides of the line. I don't know. But yeah, it's kind of inspiring.
Yeah, really is.
Yeah.
There was also a player in baseball who played with one arm, and he was a person who inspired Jack Sanders to go back and play football, actually.
Oh, gotcha.
Yeah. So just kind of an inspiring story. You know, all these players go over and they serve their country, and then some of them come back and we're able to play football too, which is really cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely is.
Yeah, so like I said, during that 5-year span from 1941 to 46, 994 people from the NFL served. 21 people lost their lives in the war. And one of the stories is he was a player for the New York Giants. His name was Al Blozes, and he was a tackle for the Giants. He was killed by machine gun fire while he was searching for missing members of his platoon. And But before that, just 6 weeks earlier, before going to Serbia in the war, the Giants played in the 1944 NFL championship game. So he went from playing in the NFL championship game to out searching for people of his platoon, and then got shot down by machine gun fire. So he was one of the 21 people who was in the NFL that got killed during World War II.
Wow. Yeah.
And that's kind of World War II summed up pretty quickly. And a big part of America history, and also a big part of the NFL's history.
Yeah, it definitely was. And the NFL, like I said, kind of took a step back because attendance went down, the competitiveness of the games went down. But after the war ended, they were able to bounce back. But also with the war ending, there was another professional league that was introduced in 1946. And they were called the All-America Football Conference, or the AAFC. The reason they came about, and it's kind of a pattern that we'll see again, is that the NFL did not want to expand or add new owners. They were stable with where they were at. They were just trying to get things, you know, a little bit more profitable, I guess. Right. And so they were closed to having new people come in because they don't want to mess up with the stability that they had created over these hard years.
Mm-hmm. So these owners wanted to start one of these leagues and then force a merger so they could own an NFL team. Gotcha.
Exactly. The AAFC, they had two big selling points. One was Arch Ward, and he, just like the NFL commissioner now, Elmer Layden, was also one of the four horsemen in the backfield for Notre Dame, and he became the commissioner. So both leagues had a four horseman commissioner, and like I said, that brought a lot of name recognition to the league right away.
Yeah, and Arch Ward actually he created the Major League Baseball All-Star Game too. So this is kind of interesting.
Oh, that is interesting. Had his hands in a
couple different things.
Yeah, that's really cool.
Yeah.
The other main selling point for the AAFC is that they managed to get Paul Brown to coach the Cleveland franchise. Paul Brown was the best college coach in the country. And back in the early days, college football was still a lot more popular than professional football. People thought that college football was just a better sport, more competitive, basically more exciting. So getting the best college coach into your league brings a lot of publicity and name recognition. The city of Cleveland was so excited to have Paul Brown, they actually named the team after Paul Brown, and they became the Cleveland Browns.
Creative.
And the NFL acted like they weren't scared, but they were a little bit scared. So they actually fired Elmer Layden, the commissioner, because he was starting to get lazy and not really doing anything as the commissioner. He was just kind of going with the flow. And so they actually secretly fired him, basically. Before the league meetings convened for the 1946 season, all the owners met the night before, and they're like, all right, we're firing this guy. Elmer Layden shows up for the league meetings, and no one's there.
Wow.
He goes back to his room, and then he eventually finds out, yeah, you got fired. Go home. We have a different commissioner now.
So did they just move the league meeting to a different place, or what did they do there?
I mean, I don't know. I guess they just didn't meet in the room that they were going to meet in, or at the right time or something. Yeah. But it's just kind of funny.
Yeah.
I mean, it's kind of sad. But
you're fired. Okay.
Yeah, the owners didn't feel like he was ready to put up or have a war between the NFL and the AAFC. So they wanted someone who's going to be strong and be able to guide the league through what they, you know, knew was going to be a tough few years coming up.
Yeah.
So they actually took Burt Bell, who was the former owner of the Eagles. He actually had to sell the Eagles because he wasn't making enough money. So they made him the commissioner, and he was actually really excited because he loved football. He loved being an owner, even though he couldn't afford it. So he's able to transition to the commissioner role, and he was really happy to take that position.
Right. Yeah. That makes sense.
Burt Bell actually became really influential in guiding the league for the next decade and a little bit. Some of the big things were that the owners in the AFC were a lot richer than the owners in the NFL. Right. So when you're not making any money, the more money you have to spare, the more time you're going to have to be able to try and make things work. So that was something that really scared him. And Dan Topping, who was the owner of the Brooklyn Dodgers football team, actually defected to the AAFC because he had gotten in a fight with the commissioner, the former commissioner Elmer Layden. And Dan Topper also owned the New York Yankees, so he was by far and away their richest owner. So losing him was also a huge blow in the money battle. But there were two things, there were a couple things, but the two big things that helped the NFL win this war is, number one, that they had been around since 1920 and they were operated all throughout the World War II. They were able to still have that recognition from the public being around for so long and not having any sort of hiatus. So they're always in the public eye. So the AFC wasn't able to have that same recognition. The other problem is that the Cleveland Browns were too good for the AAFC. They lost almost no games, and they were so good that people stopped showing up to the Cleveland Browns games because they would just be so bored that they didn't want to watch anymore.
Wow.
So another big thing that happened in this time period is that the Rams, the Cleveland Rams, got the league to let them move to Los Angeles.
Didn't it take them a long time to convince them, though? Long time.
The owners still wanted to stay very local. And basically, the owner of the Los Angeles Rams, or the Cleveland Rams at the time, Dan Reeves, said, if you don't let me move to Los Angeles or Dallas, Dallas was also a place he could move to, I am leaving and I'm going to the AAFC. This was already after Dan Topping, the Brooklyn Dodgers owner, had left. And so the NFL could not let that happen. And they said, fine, you can move to LA.
It was a big bargaining chip.
Yeah.
Yeah, for real.
And Dan Reeves, the owner of the Rams, knew that he didn't want to stay in Cleveland because the Browns were coming.
Right.
And when the Browns came, they would lose a lot of publicity because people would want to go watch the Browns instead of the Rams.
Right.
And the other big thing about the Rams moving to LA is that they wanted to play in the Coliseum, the Los Angeles Coliseum. But the Coliseum hadn't had professional football played there in over 20 years.
And I mean, when they had it, it probably wasn't like the NFL or whatever. It was probably just some guys getting paid, you know, like we talked about before, but.
And the Coliseum is the home of UCLA, you know, big college football team, and they didn't really want that competition in there.
Yeah.
So Dan Reeves went to the Coliseum Commission and said, look, we're not trying to bring competition. We want to just bring football. All types of football are good. You know, we just want everyone to be able to enjoy football how they want. And the Coliseum Commission said, well, why would they play here if there are no black people on your team?
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And so the Los Angeles Rams were basically, I don't want to say forced, but they decided to sign black players onto their team so that they could play in the Coliseum. And after they said they were going to sign a couple black players, the Coliseum let them play there.
Huh. Was that like the first team to sign black players?
Yeah.
So did they then win the championship the next year?
I don't think so. But it was a big step, and it was a year before Jackie Robinson went into Major League Baseball. Okay. Jackie Robinson gets a lot of credit, and he's obviously a big figure for integration. Yeah. But the NFL was one step ahead of baseball in that respect as well.
Thanks to the Coliseum Commission.
Yep, exactly. So they actually signed two black players that year. They were the first team to integrate. So that was a big step for the NFL.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, like I said, the AAFC kind of folded because their attendance dropped because no one wanted to watch bad teams play, and no one wanted to watch the Cleveland Browns destroy the bad teams. So the NFL offered them not really a merger, but kind of an acquisition.
Right.
So the NFL would keep three of the seven teams that the AFC had at the time, and the rest would just be dissolved. So it wasn't a real merger because more than half of the teams were gone after the AFC folded.
Right.
So the three teams that made it into the NFL were the Cleveland Browns, obviously, because they were so good.
Right.
The San Francisco 49ers, because they wanted a little bit more presence in California at that point. And the Baltimore Colts, who were actually the worst team in the AAFC.
Huh.
But they thought Baltimore would be a good football town. The NFL was the first professional sports league to have a coast-to-coast presence. So they're the first sports league. LA to New York.
That's cool.
So what's kind of interesting with these three teams, I think, is then the Baltimore Colts moved to Indianapolis and became the Indianapolis Colts. I mean, this is a while down the line, but then the Cleveland Browns moved to Baltimore and became the Baltimore Ravens. So that's kind of funny.
So everyone was kind of skeptical whether or not the AAFC was up to the same talent level as the NFL.
Yeah.
But the Browns were the cream of the crop in the NFL once they joined. So the Browns won all four championships in the AAFC, all 4 years that the AAFC was around. And then they went to the next six championships in the NFL. And they won three of those.
Okay. So
that's dominance.
Yeah, they were good. Yeah.
They were very good. And part of it was Paul Brown, of course, being an amazing coach, and he was one of the first people to kind of organize coaching in a way, right? He would have very strict practices, drills, you know, lectures on the playbook, all this stuff to make sure his team knew what they were doing all the time, and they were the best coach team in the league.
Right.
But they also had Otto Graham, who was a sensational quarterback back in the day. So this kind of moves us into the 1950s because the AAFC and the NFL, merged. I guess it's not the merger we're talking about, but it was a type of merger.
It was a merger.
Kind of. You know, it's more of an acquisition, I guess, than a merger.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And they merged in 1950. So I guess we can move into the 1950s now. And the 1950s were the big decade for football. It's when everything started to click. And there were a few reasons for this. The first was football started to become a serious, you know, sport.
Right.
Where people, the more attention you paid to football, the more you understood it, the more enjoyment you got out of it.
Right.
Kind of like baseball. Right, where, you know, you can really dive deep into the stats of baseball and start to really understand how players are doing, you know, how, like, their performances and stuff. Football started to fall into that same category.
Yeah,
where
I think that's with any sport. Basically, the more interested you are, the more you know about it, the more interested you'll be, and so on.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
For sure.
Yeah. So I think this is the point where football kind of moved into that category where people started to realize that it was such a complex game and so strategic.
Mm-hmm.
And there was also more action than baseball, where baseball was a very relaxed sport, you know, with the at-bats taking a little bit longer, whereas football was a lot more, you know, bang, bang, bang.
Yeah.
More things happening on the field at once. So people kind of liked that a little bit more as well. So that was one of the reasons that football started growing in popularity. Another reason was because of television, where television in 1950 was just starting to become more of a mainstream media.
Yeah.
So sports were starting to experiment with it. Baseball was starting to make some TV deals, but they started seeing some bad effects because when people would watch it at home, they want to go to the games.
Yeah.
Right.
So the Los Angeles Rams, Dan Reeves, the owner, went to a TV company and you said, I'm happy to make a TV deal with you, but the deal is that all the money that I lose from people not coming to the games, you pay me back. It was a little bit of an experiment on his part and the TV station's part.
Yeah.
And sure enough, the Los Angeles Rams lost a lot of attendance money, and so the TV station ended up paying the Rams over $300,000.
Wow.
In lost ticket sales.
Wow, that's crazy.
Yeah. And obviously $300,000 was a ton of money back then.
Uh-huh.
So that was kind of the first experiment, and the NFL is hesitant to move forward with TV deals, especially when you could put a price tag on the amount of money lost at this point. Yeah. But what ended up happening is they made a deal with TV companies that if the team was playing at home within a 75-mile radius, the TV stations could not show the game. Also known as a blackout.
Yeah, that sucks.
Okay, so a clarifying question here. So back then, mm-hmm. was it just if a team was playing within 75 miles or if they didn't have enough attendance?
Just if they were playing.
Okay, so now it's if they don't have enough attendance.
Yep, exactly. Yeah.
Right.
But what it actually helped attendance grow, because when they were playing at home, people had to go watch. But when they were playing away, it garnered more interest in the team because they got to watch the team play when they weren't playing at home.
Yeah.
That I think that is interesting too. I think it's kind of like today how it's kind of interesting if we get a letter instead of an email. But I think it's like when they first started being on TV, everyone wanted to watch them on TV. Whereas now, if you had a choice between actually going to a game or watching on TV, it's obviously you want to go to a game.
Yep, that's definitely true. There was also more strategy being introduced to the game in the 1950s. Part of that was a coach named Sid Gilman. He coached for the Rams in LA, and his dad owned a movie theater. And so Sid Gilman knew a lot about film. And so he was one of the first coaches to bring film study into the NFL, where he would cut specific plays so he could see all the plays run by a team in a certain formation, all the plays run by like a receiver where he caught the ball or something, all the running plays, all the passing. He would cut all these films. It was actual film back then, not a digital file. He would cut them all by hand and organize them and label them so he would know, okay, these are ones I want to watch to study this person or this team or, you know, this formation.
Wow.
Which is fun because now, obviously, it's all digital, everything, you know, high school, college, NFL, whatever, whenever you're watching it, but I mean, it's still called watching film.
Yep, exactly.
That sounds like he would have spent a lot of time cutting film and organizing it, but that's impressive.
Yeah, he actually spent so much time, they hired somebody to do it for him.
Wow.
Right.
So he could actually coach some more.
Yeah.
But yeah, so he was the first person to really bring in the film study and watching film. So other coaches, here's one that I thought was really interesting. New York Giants, they had their head coach, and it was kind of a system similar to what we see today, where the head coach, and then there was the offensive coordinator and the defensive coordinator. Right? Whereas kind of before, it was mostly the head coach kind of doing everything with a couple of assistants.
Yeah.
But on the Giants, at one point, their offensive coordinator was Vince Lombardi.
Oh.
Their defensive coordinator was Tom Landry.
Wow.
And who was the head coach then?
I don't know. I don't remember.
Well, dang. That's crazy.
It's a pretty stacked coaching staff.
Yeah, you have two legendary coaches, one running your offense and one running your defense. You're in pretty good shape. They won at least one championship during those years.
Yeah.
The second to last big thing that happened in the 1950s was the NFL championship game in 1958. It was played between the Giants and the Colts. And people now call that championship game the greatest game ever played. Uh-huh. It was one of the first nationally televised games, football games. 45 million people watched this game. Wow. It went to overtime. It was back and forth. It was this crazy game. Johnny Unitas was the quarterback for the Colts. Of course, he had the two coordinators for the Giants. He had Sam Huff playing middle linebacker, Frank Gifford on the Giants. And it was just this clash of powers, and it was this crazy game. It went to overtime. The broadcast was actually interrupted because it went over the time, and so many people called NBC saying, "Where'd the football game go? It wasn't over."
Yeah.
The Colts win in overtime. They go home, and their runway is sworn by over 30,000 people. The buses couldn't even leave the airport because there was a huge mob of fans.
Wow.
I mean, imagine that, though. You're watching the Patriots Falcons game that goes into overtime, and as it goes into overtime, it gets cut off.
It would be terrible.
Yeah.
So people were very upset, but that was the turning point for the NFL in terms of popularity. Yeah. That's the point where the NFL went from struggling, you know, not very profitable league to, you know, at that point it started becoming the professional sports league in America because of that one game.
Yeah, and so in that game, Raymond Berry, the Colts wide receiver, had 12 catches, 178 yards and a touchdown. And his 12 catches was the record in a championship game up until Super Bowl 48 when Demaryius Thomas broke it.
Wow.
Wow.
And I think the Unitas to Berry connection is what helped them score on their last couple drives as well. Because Unitas went to Berry and they had that mind meld that we see with Julian Edelman and Tom Brady today. So that was the defining moment in NFL. Well, not the defining moment, but at least in the 50s, that was the moment that changed everything for the NFL.
Made football really relevant.
Yep. It actually inspired some people, including Lamar Hunt, who we'll talk about in our next episode, to call up the NFL and ask for an expansion franchise because after watching that game, he knew he wanted to be a football owner, a football franchise owner.
Right.
Yeah.
So like I said, Burt Bell, I didn't talk about him too much, but he was the commissioner at this point. He's actually a really interesting person. We could do an episode on him later. But he helped guide the NFL through the years from 1946 to 1959 and helped in the 50s being such a big change for the NFL. He helped engineer all those TV deals, making sure NFL or football was the best product on TV.
Right.
He knew he was going to retire from commissioner at the end of the 1959 season, and then he was going to buy the Eagles back and become an owner, which was his lifelong dream, and he loved being an owner. Him and his son went to an Eagles game, and he actually had a heart attack at the game and died.
Wow.
And this was the point where the NFL knew the AFL was coming because Lamar Hunt and a few other people had been calling, trying to get a franchise, and they had been denied. And they had decided they were going to start their own league, and it was announced they were starting their league. And so the NFL was in a tricky situation heading in to the 60s, knowing that this rival league was coming, and they just lost their really good commissioner to an unexpected heart attack.
Uh-huh.
So that's kind of where we'll leave our narrative at this point. And in our next episode, we'll kind of talk about the AFL, which is the new league, and kind of how that affected the NFL and what came of it.
All right.
Sounds good.
So this was a lot of fun. I really enjoyed talking to you guys about NFL history. It was a lot of fun. I feel like I learned a lot. I hope you guys learned a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, for sure.
Especially when it was so old. So, I mean, before, I mean, anything close to what we know football today, didn't know, I would say, 90% of this stuff.
Yeah. It's a lot of fun going back so far and learning about it because it's kind of ancient history when it comes to football, anything before the 60s.
Yeah, before the Super Bowl. It was really the first Super Bowl.
Yep. Yeah, so it's a lot of fun. Thank you, everyone who listened to this. Rate us 5 stars, subscribe, leave us a review. Yeah, and we hope you tune in for our next episode. It was a lot of fun, and I'm excited to talk with you guys about the AFL in our next episode.
Yeah.
Thank you for listening.